Okay, so Rashi, I was online this morning and I saw your name popping up everywhere.
Don't believe everything you see. They're just pissed off.
They say your campaign for president has been rocked with scandal. What's all that about?
You know what, Dad? They're trying to tell me that $3 million is too much to spend on having Elton John do my commercials, but they're wrong.
You spent $3 million on Elton John?
Hey, a monkey's got to have good style if he's going to get elected.
Hi, this is Paul Dini.
Oh, this is Misty Lee, and we have Mark Evan here again.
You always have Mark Evan here
I
again.
Love it!
All right.
Did you, Elton John, $3 million?
You know I don't even like to listen to him. I can't with Rashi and this BS with this Elton John nonsense.
I don't want Elton John over here.
And you know what's the worst thing about this whole scandal? Is Elton John's getting a ton of airtime and airplane. I've got earworms all week long.
Elton John does not need another $3 million. I'm sorry.
He's got to keep all those fresh flowers in his foyer.
I mean, if Rashi's going to... I don't care how he gets that money. He should be keeping it at home.
Be keeping it at home. Therein lies the real issue.
I suspect so.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yep.
So, Mark.
Yes, hello.
We were talking
about that musical note you just did.
Yes.
Do you know who wrote that?
You?
No, no.
Who? Dun, dun,
dun, Billy Barnes.
Really?
Yes. He wrote that for Laughing. And he published it under ASCAP. And every time people play that on the radio, and he gets money.
How much do I owe him?
Well, you're not paying ASCAP fees on this broadcast. But it's very interesting. Composers, get paid by ASCAP use. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by the fact that the song that every composer, the song that you'd think their biggest hit is not always the one they made the most money off of. Mm-hmm. Frank Lesser, who wrote Guys and Dolls and How to Sustain Business, the song he wrote, tons of famous songs, Luck Be a Lady Tonight and all these things.
Yeah.
The song that he wrote that made him the most money was The Brotherhood of Man from How to Succeed in Business because it was turned into the Hams Beer song.
Oh my God.
For the years. Great beer Brotherhood of Hams.
That's right.
Yeah.
The song that Kalmar and Ruby wrote, the great songwriters who wrote Three Little Words and all these other great songs. The song that they made the most money off of was Hooray for Captain Spaulding because Groucho used it as his theme song on the radio show for 25 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So Billy Barnes wrote one of these wonderful songs like Have I Stayed Too Long at the Fair and all these things. And the song that he made the most money off of was called Laughing Bumper, that thing you just did.
Wow.
Yep.
Have you ever written a song for any of your shows?
I've written lots of songs for my shows, yes.
Yeah. Which ones?
Well, I've written songs for The Garfield Show. I've written songs for Channel Empty 3. And I wrote a lot of songs on the Sid and Marty Krofft variety shows. And I wrote a lot of the special music. I wrote songs with Billy Barnes on
you
one
did?
Of those shows, yes.
Do you write the music or the lyrics?
I usually write the lyrics, but once or twice I wrote the music by singing it into a tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I write.
Yeah. And
that's kind of how
Mel Brooks writes his songs.
Is it really?
Yes.
And then you give it to somebody who fleshes it out
and transcribes it for
you.
Yes.
And...
Yeah.
That's how I write cartoons for, over at Warner Brothers on Duck Dodgers and various other things is I'll come up with a song and I'll say, this is sort of like, this has a heroic kind of Western feel to it. And I'll hum something like that. And then, at least in one case, we had an assistant who was very good at transcribing it, and he was able to play an accompaniment on the guitar. And then we gave that to Writers in the Sky, and then they just sang it to their they didn't even do an arrangement; they just sang it as they felt it should be sung.
Wow!
And but I'll do that with I wrote something recently, and it had a certain sort of rhyme scheme that I could equate it to another song. And so when it comes time to explain it to the composer, I'm just going to go in and sing it as I hear it. But that's, I don't read music very well. I certainly don't write music very well. And I can kind of plunk it. Like you've heard me, I'll plunk out something on the ukulele when I'm sort of composing.
Mark, do you play any instruments?
No.
All right.
None.
That went nowhere.
Nope.
I'm just kidding.
Did I tell the story on this?
Well, you're not getting off the hook with Sid and Marty Krofft.
Okay,
either, but time I say we're going to talk about him, and every time we don't, Scott Adsit.
Did I tell the story about
Trisha Lasky now?
Did I tell the story about working with George Hearn?
I don't
before?
Think so. Do we know this story?
On Garfield, right?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, I have a story.
Oh, I can't believe it.
I have an anecdote. All right. we're doing Garfield, and an agent takes me out to lunch, a voice actor agent, and pitches me on a lot of celebrity clients.
Okay.
To hire. I don't want celebrities on the show because they're celebrities. There are people we hired on the show. Like, I had Don Knotts on the show, not because he was a celebrity, because he was Don Knotts.
Sure.
We had George Foreman on the show because he asked me to be on it, you mm-hmm. know. We had a few people, like, you know, but I hire people I like who are good actors.
Mm-hmm.
So the agent's going through these, all these people who are on sitcoms, you know, they want to do cartoon voices. I go, no, thanks. And the agent says, we represent George Hearn. I go, George Hearn? George Hearn? Sweeney Todd George Hearn? Yeah. Star of Broadway George Hearn?
Mm-hmm.
Get me George Hearn. I'll take George Hearn. We'll do a musical episode. He was in town, L.A., because he was doing Max the Butler in Sunset Boulevard over at the Schubert with Glenn Close.
Wow. Yep.
Great show.
So... Most of the songs we wrote on the show, on the Garfield and Friends show, I would write the lyrics, and a man named Ed Bogus, who lives in San Francisco, would write the music.
Okay.
And I would just email him the songs or fax them to him, and he'd call me up and play the song. And then he would send me down a scratch track tape. He would send a tape down that had the instrumental version, a piano track that the actors could sing to, and then later he would and it would have a vocal on it. Ed would sing the lyrics. And they would learn the song from the tape, they'd sing to it, and then later when the show was finished, he would knock out that music, leave their vocals, and record actual instrumentation with full sound. So we wrote this musical episode, and I was really under the gun, and last minute, I wrote this thing, and I sent it to Ed, and he sent me down the scratch track the day before the recording. We had George Hearn booked for, I think it was like, say it's Wednesday. Tuesday morning, I get the track, I listen to it that evening, and I go, oh, this isn't very good. And I just go, I did a bad job.
Ooh.
And I called Ed up, and I said, Ed, I just listened to this, and I'm not happy with what I did. I think I stuck you with some bad things. And he said, yeah, I wasn't wild about what you did, Mark, but I trust you. And I go, well, we can't have George Hearn sing this stuff. It's not worthy of him. So he says, well, what do you want to do? I said, I think we're going to rewrite it tonight.
Nice.
Now, this is like 6 o'clock in the evening. We're recording the next morning at 9 a.m.
That's right.
So we spent all night rewriting the thing. And I would be phoning Ed every hour and giving him new lyrics. And he'd phone me and play me the thing. And we were writing this. It ended up being like a 14-minute episode. It was a very long, elaborate thing. I got to bed about 4 a.m. Ed got to bed about 3 a.m. Ed got up at 6 a.m., drove to the San Francisco airport, got on a plane, came down here, rented a car. He had brought with him a keyboard, portable keyboard,
mm-hmm.
and we did it live. He played the songs live at the studio into the actors' headsets.
Wow.
And we recorded this musical episode with George Hearn playing the villain. It was called The Man Who Hated Cats.
Nice.
And... needless to say, I was kind of zombie-eyed and not able to, I was not awake.
Yes.
So George Hearn, Mr. Hearn, lovely man, he says to me afterwards how much he enjoyed doing the thing. He says, hey, I want you to be my guest. Come tonight to the Schubert Theater on me and see Sunset Boulevard. I'll give you house seats and I'll comp you and bring a woman or whatever you got and be my guest. And I was so sleepy. I didn't think to say, could I come tomorrow night or the next night? I said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And he left, and I went, I guess I'm stuck going tonight.
Yeah.
All right? Now, at that time, my friend Jewel Shepherd, Jewel was out of town, so I took another lady to see this thing. We go to see the show. Mr. Hearn has arranged for us to get second row center seats.
Oh, no.
And these are bad because he can see me from the stage.
That's what I was just
saying. And I'm trying to, I keep starting to doze off.
Yeah.
But I managed to stay awake long enough. We saw the show. We go backstage afterwards. He took us on a tour of the set, which was an amazing set. He introduced us to Glenn Close. We talked to her for a while. We talked to some other people in the cast. A wonderful evening. Fade out. Fade in. A week later, Jewel's back in town. And she says, what happened while I was away? And I told her this. Oh, I went to see Sunset Boulevard with Glenn Close. She said, what? You went without me? I said, yeah, well, and I told her why. And she said, oh, well, you better get on the phone right now and get more tickets to see Sunset Boulevard with Glenn Close because I have to see it. I have to see that. We must see this.
This is an emergency.
And she demands this.
Yes, yes.
So I called George Hearn.
And by the way, you don't say no to Jewel.
No, you don't say no to
Jewel. You don't dare.
So I called George Hearn and I said, I want to pay for the seats this time. This time I'm paying for them, but can you get me house seats again? He says, okay, fine, sure. And he arranges them for a certain night. Jewel and I get all dressed up. I take her to a fancy restaurant on the way. We get to the Schubert Theater. And there's a mob scene of people yelling and screaming outside.
Oh, no.
Glenn Close is out. The understudy is on that night.
Oh, no.
And there's a man who works for the Schubert. He has a shaven head, I guess in honor of the character, the Max, that George was playing in the play. And this other way, he's wearing a suit, and he is running around trying to bring order out of the chaos outside. There are people who want to go in and see the understudy, and they have to get their tickets at will call. And there are people there who are demanding refunds, and they're crowding the lines, and he's trying to get the people who don't want to see the understudy. First of all, he's trying to talk them into seeing the understudy.
Sure.
And secondly, he's saying, no, go over to this line here, and he's trying to write herd on this, and it's quite a chaotic.
Let the people in who need to get in.
So I turn to Jewel and I say, do you want to see the understudy, or do you want to come back another time and see Glenn Close? She said, I'm not interested in anything to play. I want to see Glenn Close. So I said, okay, we'll wait here till they start the thing, and then we'll exchange our tickets for another night. So we're standing there, and there is a man outside who just loses it. He's so angry. He has come out specifically to see Glenn Close in Sunset Boulevard. He planned his vacation. He is staying at the Century Plaza Hotel across the street, and he can't come back another day. This is his last day in L.A., and he is yelling and screaming as he seems to think that if he yells and screams enough, Glenn Close will go on and do the show.
And hear him, yes.
Miss Close is actually home with the flu. Mm-hmm. And the guy for the Schubert, people are all basically standing around watching this man screaming. And the guy for the Schubert is saying, calm down, sir. And he says, I'm not going to calm down. I came out here. What are you going to, you know? And he finally says, what are you going to do for me? I came out here. I spent $300 for the plane fare. I spent $200 for the hotel. I got these tickets. I can't come back. What are you going to do for me? So the guy from the Schubert says, well, we can validate your parking. He says, I walked over from the Schubert, from the Century Plaza. And so the guy reaches into his pocket, the Schubert guy, and he pulls out a cigar. He says, here, have a cigar. Calm down, sir. You know, and the man swats the cigar out of his hand and says, I don't want a damn cigar. And everybody's kind of watching this. And I yell out, cigar, but no Close. There's this moment there of like shock, and people, they all turn their anger on me.
Oh.
And I said to Jewel, let's go, let's get out of here. We'll come back another time and change the tickets. And we left. Okay. So as it turned out, we didn't get back to see Glenn Close there. A couple weeks later, I am at a party of writers, TV writers and such, and we're all sitting around talking, and people start telling about bad puns. So I tell the story about the cigar, Close but no cigar, cigar but no Close, and everybody, some people laugh. And then one writer, fellow named Ian Abrams, a TV writer friend of mine, says, you didn't say that. I go, what? You know, couldn't have come up with that. And he calls me a liar.
Wow.
And I say, well, I said it. I've got witnesses. He says, yeah, your girlfriend. Yeah, she'll back you up. Yeah, you don't have, you know. So we argue about this. And I go, look, if you don't want to believe it, okay, fine. You don't have to believe it. I said it, and it got a laugh from some people there. Okay. Now, a couple months later, I'm in New York. They have taken Sunset Boulevard from L.A. to New York. It's playing on Broadway. And I have lunch with George Hearn, and he arranges for me to go see the show again with I think Carol Lay, as a matter of fact. She was living back there at the time. But I had lunch with him, and we're talking, and I tell him about being there, and he starts telling me, oh, we heard about that. There was some guy out there who yelled
cigar,
but no Close. I said, that was me. He goes, oh my God, that's you. Oh, that's you know, I should have known it was you, because I knew you were coming that night. Oh, I should have put those two together. Okay, so we talked about that. So again, we went back to the stage, and we met Glenn Close, and George Hearn tells her, this is the guy who said that line. And he said, oh, okay. So now,
show business legend,
all right?
Yeah.
I come back to L.A. A couple weeks later, I get the rough cut of the episode of Garfield that Mr. Hearn was in. I sent him a copy of it in New York. 3-4 days later, phone rings, George Hearn. He goes, Mark, that was a great, I was real happy when that came out, and it's really good, it's a wonderful episode, I'm so proud of this thing. I've got a friend here who wants to tell you how much he loves it. So he puts someone on the phone with me, and this man on the phone, on the line says, sir, you did a very good job on those lyrics. I hope you stay at it, because you have a nice bet with lyrics. I say, thank you. Who are you? He says, Steve Sondheim.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And I go, nice. I'm gonna chef of the future. And he sends me a note. He sends me a note saying, congratulations on the final lyric job. You think
like
that?
Nice.
I have a house. Mother of God.
Right. Okay. Okay, so now I think to myself, well, that's the perfect ending to this story.
Mm-hmm.
2 days later, I'm about to go to another one of those writers' parties.
Okay. Yeah.
And just before I'm leaving, the mail comes. I open it up, and there's a new issue of Show Music Magazine, and there's an interview with Glenn Close in it.
Oh,
and
no.
She tells the story about the Cigar But No Close, and she doesn't remember my name, but she says, I don't remember the guy's name, but he was the guy who writes the Garfield cartoon show. He said that. So I go to the party and I go, forget the Stephen Sondheim letter. I got Ian Abrams cold here. I got proof.
Yeah. So you rolled it up and hit him on the face.
Yes, that's right. Nice. And that was my triumphant moment, was that I went to Ian and said, oh, Ian, I have something here you'd like you to read, please.
In writing from Glenn Close's
mouth.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So.
Oh my God, that's brilliant.
That's the story.
Satisfaction.
That's right. That,
guaranteed.
That was all worth it for that moment when I walk in with the magazine.
Oh, mm-hmm. It's perfect. Yes. Oh, that's brilliant. So are you ever going to tell us about working on the Croft shows? Because, I mean, you seem to really try to be
I went to work for Sid and Marty Croft in 77 or something like that.
I was one.
Well, okay. My partner, my partner Dennis and I had split up.
Okay.
Amicably, we're still friends. We're having lunch next week.
Just not dating anymore.
Not dating anymore. And my agent sent me over to meet the producers. Sid and Marty Croft had a series. They were looking for writers. I went over. The people there liked me. And I got hired to write a show with the Bay City Rollers.
Okay.
The first of many shows I wrote for the Crofts, starring people who didn't speak English very well.
No, not English. What was their native language?
They were Scottish.
Nice.
And they could speak, they spoke English, but not very intelligibly. They were singers. They were not performers. They were not comedy performers anyway. We had them in sketches, and we had them talking and welcoming people. And that, they couldn't have done that, you know. They just weren't professional enough to be MCs to begin with. But also, they had these thick Scottish accents. And even though we had them work with a dialogue coach, it was not.
Unintelligible.
It was not very good. But that show was bizarre because outside the studio at KTLA, which I mentioned the other week in the show, we had every 15-year-old girl in Los Angeles camped out.
Why? Who was there?
Because they loved the Bay City Rollers. They were fans of them. And when I went to the Roller, we had the Rollers staying in a house in Laurel Canyon. When I would have to drive over there to go over material with them, there'd be like 8 teenage girls in a Volkswagen Rabbit following me. Trying to find out where the Rollers were.
And they were the S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y night guys, right?
That's right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so then I got along well with Sid and Marty Croft and their producer people there. And I just did every show they did for the next 10 or 15 years.
Every show?
Just about, I think so.
Except for Land of the Lost, probably.
Well, Land of the Lost was before that.
Oh, okay.
But I did
all the variety
specials and series and things like that, and Saturday morning shows. I did the Richard Pryor Saturday morning show with them.
That was great.
And I did, they just kept hiring me for everything after that. And
then you brought them to Comic-Con.
I brought them. Well, no, I didn't bring them to Comic-Con. Well, they came on their own semi. I kind of arranged it partly, but we had them on. One of the great moments was I had to make a surprise appearance on the cartoon voice panel, and the audience just went nuts seeing them there. They're, you know, it's interesting that they are again parts of relics of childhood.
Yeah,
we are now the right age, where a lot of us grew up on H.R. Puff and stuff, or Lidsville, or Land of the Lost, and it's interesting that when I went to work for the Crofts in 77, I think, or 78, whatever it was. If you had at that point said, oh, let's put out Dolls of Lidsville.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a dead show. It was canceled. Nobody cares about it.
Yeah.
It got hot again 20 years later. It came back, and And there's now merchandise, there's lunch boxes of these things being made and such because of that arc where now all of a sudden, you know, the people who grew up in the shows are parents. And they want to introduce them to their kids or they want, or they just want that relic of their childhood. They want to have these.
A little
these,
bit of income.
They were really kind of kings stuff. Of Saturday morning for a long time, them and Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah.
You know,
and
one was the other.
And I worked for them for years. And the neat part was they knew everybody. They'd worked with everyone. They did big production. You were asking me on one of the previous shows, I don't remember which one because we this is the fourth one we've done tonight. whether I like writing alone or Paul was asking like writing alone or writing the people. Well, when I did the Croft shows, you're on the set. There's comedians. There's cute girl dancers.
Mm-hmm.
There's celebrities.
There's a guy in a googly-eyed spider suit.
There's a guy in a googly-eyed spider suit. There's a live audience frequently.
Mm-hmm.
That's show business.
Mm-hmm.
I just loved that, seeing how it all was done and listening to all those people and being around it. And this amazing thing that you have in television where, you know, you'd sit down and write and once you sit down and write exterior, interior, haunted house, and they build a haunted house.
Yeah.
You write a joke and suddenly they've spent $100,000 building scenery or they've hired actors. It is an amazing thing. When I was doing Welcome Back, Cotter, we had an episode that we needed to have somebody play Gabe Kaplan's father, Gabe Cotter's, Mr. Cotter's father.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to cast it. They'd written this episode. They had a star in mind for the role. They couldn't get him, and the network didn't want him. So we had to cast it. So we're sitting around tossing out ideas, and I said, you know the guy who plays great Jewish fathers and who looks a little like Gabe? Harold J. Stone. And the other producers went, who's Harold J. Stone? They didn't know the name.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, he's a character actor. He's done a lot of things. And they said, oh, okay, well, we'll look him up or something like that. So I went out of the office, and about 2 hours later, I'm walking through the office again, and sitting in the waiting room, which we shared with a couple of other shows, was Harold J. Stone, is sitting there reading a newspaper.
Huh.
And like a jerk, because I do stupid things all the time, I run up to the producer's office. I said, you won't believe this. Remember I mentioned Harold J. Stone earlier? Well, he's sitting right down in the waiting room right now. Isn't that an amazing coincidence? And they said, no, we sent for him.
Oh, God.
And I went, oh. Yeah, I guess that would work too, wouldn't it?
They looked him up and liked him.
And he ended up playing Gabe Kaplan's father. And
now, how did you know who he was? What did you
I just
seen him
had in? Seen him in things. I'd seen mm-hmm. him in, he was on a regular on a show called My World and Welcome to It.
Which, mm-hmm.
But he was one of those guys who was always on, he was on Bridget Loves Bernie. He was on, and he was in a movie, one of those, you know, rotten, terrible movies that we all know called The Man with X-Ray Eyes, starring Ray Milland.
Yeah.
And literally, while we were rehearsing the show one day, there was a scene he wasn't in, and he was sitting out in the lobby, and there was a TV set there, and we turned it on, and there's The Man with X-Ray Eyes. And we sat there watching his scene. He gets killed off in the first 15 minutes of the movie. And he did like a live commentary track about how much he hated Roger Corman and hated the job and hated the movie and hated Ray Milland.
Wow.
And
hated working topless like everybody in
that's
Corman
right.
movies did.
That's right, yes. And so, I mean, that was the neat part of show business for me was bonding with those people. And I was more interested in the Harold J. Stones than I was in the the big celebrity people we'd had on the shows.
You mentioned Burt Mustin.
Burt Mustin, yeah.
He was every old man.
Yeah.
No matter where you saw him, he would show up on Bewitched one week, and then he'd be on Twilight Zone the next or something. I remember like he was in that Christmas episode of Twilight Zone I like a lot with Art Carney.
Night of the Meek.
Yeah, he plays one of the old guys. In fact, they call him Burt. They had to give him a name. They go, here you go, Burt, a new pipe, you know, and that's him. He played every old man, and he always looked the same. I believe he got into acting when he was fairly elderly, and then just always looked that way.
People always assumed that he was like been an actor for all his life. He became an actor when he was like 70, and he was an actor, worked all the time until he was about 95.
Wow.
And there was an actor that you mentioned, you used to mention on your site, and I'm blanking on his name. He passed away within the last 2 years, But he
Charles
was
Lane.
Charles Lane. Everything.
The Charles Lane. I worked with Dabbs Greer. You know, I mean, these guys were these character actors that have been around. I worked with Lou Krugman.
Wow.
These are people who've just.
They knew the business inside and out, mm-hmm. and they did the work.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but I mean, mm-hmm. it was used to. I worked with Peter Leeds. Peter Leeds. Peter Leeds was the workingest actor in SAG for many years,
uh-huh.
and you can't tell anybody who he was because he never had a signature role. For a long time, Jamie Farr was like that. Jamie Farr was in everything, but you couldn't. There's no way to tell anybody who Jamie Farr was. And then one day he got Klinger, so yeah. now if you say, well, he was Corporal Klinger on MASH, okay, now I know who he is.
But that even Peter took him a few years.
Pardon?
That even took him a few years because Klinger wasn't really a main character
yeah,
in the show
yeah.
for
yeah,
four or five years.
He was a one-shot character mm-hmm. that brought back a few times, and he finally made him a regular. But Peter Leeds was like Jamie Farr for a long time, but he never got that signature identifiable role.
Patty Duke's father.
William Shallard.
There you go.
William Shallard was in everything in the world. Right. And Patty Duke's father is the only way you can describe him to some people.
Other than the president of the actors of SAG for a
yeah.
long time.
Or the old admiral on Get Smart. He was
there you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was always fascinated by those guys who made whole careers doing bit parts or small roles. I'm in such awe of actors and performers, people who can get in front of a camera or a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love the fact that these people have made their careers doing this thing and doing it. I love the fact. I mean, among the many reasons I love June Foray is to just realize how much that woman has done, how mm-hmm. many voiceovers and commercials and dubbing other actors. And, you know, I'll sit there watching a movie and they go, my God, June Foray. I call up June. June, do you know you were in this movie? And she go, I was? Oh, I was watching... The comic, the Dick Van Dyke movie, The Comic. There's a little boy in that movie. He's the son that plays Dick Van Dyke's son. He's dubbed by June. I didn't realize it the first five times I saw it. I found
out. Really?
Wait a minute, that's June. You know, I mean, it's like, there's in the movie The Hospital with George C. Scott, there's a long scene with George C. Scott and Diana Rigg.
Mm-hmm.
One scene, and if you listen for it, you might be able to figure out which one it is. One scene where Diana Rigg is completely redubbed by June Foray.
Do they sound alike?
She did a good imitation of her.
Wow.
It's good enough. It's if you listen for it, you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't. I didn't catch it in the theater when I saw the movie. You do catch her in some things. She's in Bells Are Ringing. In Bells Are Ringing, she's all throughout that movie. She and Paul Frees dubbing other actors or off-camera voices.
Were they doing ADR loop group stuff for that, or were they actually doing voice matching? Because June has such a distinctive texture.
Well, in that particular case, she wasn't voice matching. That movie was about Judy Holliday playing an answering machine, an answering service lady. So she's got all these voices on the phone you hear, and half of them are Paul Frees or June Foray.
Sure,
but then there's a scene in there. There's a song in there called "Drop That Name," and. There's all these, it's a song, and all these singers and dancers in it are singing different lines, and two of the men and one of the women are, two of the men are dubbed by Paul Frees, and one of the women is dubbed by June Foray. And, okay. and it's like Boris, and they sound like Boris and Natasha
awesome.
Have looped mm-hmm. these two people in this scene. If you watch the movie Gigi, at the beginning there's a scene where Louis Jordan is in a house, French house, and there's three men, three servants talking to him, the Whittingham, they're all dubbed by Paul Frees, all three of them.
Wow.
And I just love that stuff. It's fascinated by it. And June has been through... The things she's done, you can't even keep track of. On the old Beretta
and
show...
You never know.
On the old Beretta show, every week, there'd be a scene where Robert Blake would dress up as a little old lady to stake someone out. And when he played a little old lady, June dubbed his voice.
Wow.
Wow. I mean, things like that. She pops up.
Now, did she ever do any on-camera work?
Yes,
or was she
primarily
off?
She was actually in a couple of episodes of Green Acres playing a Spanish telephone operator.
Wow.
And she was in, she was on an old kids show, Andy's Gang. She was on camera in that. And there's a movie called Sabuku, I think it's called. It's a jungle movie
mm-hmm.
where she plays the heroine. It's the sexy girl heroine, the jungle girl.
Well, and, she's so tiny.
Yes.
I bet she was, I mean, she's still quite lovely.
She's getting smaller and smaller.
She's shrinking. Yeah, she's from now on,
they're not going to drive her to Sessions. They're just going to FedEx her to them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She probably could fit in a large envelope. Yeah. But she's so tiny and she's so lovely. Mm-hmm. And every time she comes, you know, you taught me, it's interesting because you teach so much just in a sentence or two if someone's listening. And one of the first sessions I ever came to watch when you were working on Garfield, June was there. And you put your arm around her and you said, the perfect picture of professionalism. She always comes in ready to work. She's always 15 minutes early. She's got a great attitude. And doesn't she look lovely? And she was dressed perfectly professionally. She looked amazing. Yes. And she's how old now?
94 now.
Okay. You know, I mean, it's
And she doesn't wear glasses.
She doesn't. Can she actually see, or does she just?
She doesn't need them. She doesn't need glasses.
At 94.
At 94.
Yeah. Did she have LASIK or something?
No.
Wow. Wow. This and is, she is. I want to be Jean
Foray when I grow up.
Yeah. And this is a woman.
The trick is to not grow up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a woman who can hold her own. She can hold her own with the men in every single way. Like, you know, I mean, like, there, she was tough as nails. Yeah. She had to be salty and tough as nails to survive.
Yeah. But to get back to Sid and Marty Krofft,
oh, yeah.
When I worked for Sid and Marty Krofft, first of all, you don't work for Sid and Marty Krofft. You get adopted into the family.
Oh, that's
And I was
nice.
Worked on all their shows. But it was like, for example, the Bay City Roller show I mentioned, it was directed by a man named Jack Regas.
Okay.
Jack Regas went backward. Before he was a direct TV director, he was a top TV director, he was a top choreographer. Before he was a top choreographer, he was a top dancer. Remember one of the MGM movie musicals, I think it was Eats Parade, Judy Garland sings Get Happy. There's that number where she's singing, she's wearing the tuxedo jacket. And there's six, Summer Stock, right. There's six handsome men dancing around her. One of those is Jack Regas.
Wow.
And I sat with Jack Regas and talked about MGM movie musicals. He was a house dancer. He was in all those musicals. Our dialogue coach, the guy who tried to teach the Bay City Rollers to talk and who was help assisting, was a man named Jonathan Lucas, who starred in the 1951 or 52 revival of The I Sing, directed by George S. Kaufman.
Oh my gosh, that gave me a shiver.
And who later became, this was a fascinating man, he was sadly the first person I knew who died of AIDS. Mm. But Jonathan was one of these guys who was a troubleshooter for shows. They'd bring him in to stage acts, or if somebody couldn't, like a performer couldn't match them, they'd bring him in, he'd coach them. He'd be like a Henry Higgins, coaching them in the lines or staging their acts or teaching them stuff. He taught, Motown had him under contract. He was a white guy, but Motown had him under contract to work out all the choreography for the Temptations and the Supremes. They kept it a secret because they didn't want to know a white guy was staging all that. Mm-hmm. That was Jonathan Lucas.
Wow.
And he was also the guy who staged all the stuff on for the Gold Diggers and the Dean Martin show. He was one of the people who helped stage all the Dean Martin show stuff.
Wow.
When I had gone over, like I said earlier on one of the previous shows, I used to go over and watch at NBC. I used to watch them tape Bob Hope or tape Laughing or tape Johnny Carson. I'd go over to the Dean Martin show and I'd watch the Gold Diggers rehearse, and Jonathan was choreographing those numbers. And then years later, I'm working with the guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he was a fount of history. He'd worked with everybody in the show business, and all these. And Sid, you know, Sid Krofft was the opening act for Liberace, and he had all these great Liberace stories. He put me on the phone once with Liberace.
Oh my gosh!
You know, and then we'd be sitting. You know, every time I was working with Sid and Marty Krofft, something would. It's like you go to work and there's something new happen. One time I went in. We were doing Pink Lady.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I go into Marty. We were having this problem. We couldn't get guest stars on the show.
Why?
We could not. Nobody wanted to be on the show.
Oh.
They didn't want the show. They didn't want to work with these two girls who couldn't speak English very well.
Mm-hmm.
And we're desperate for somebody. And literally, we have to start writing this. The guy from the set designer would come to me and he'd say, "What sets do you want me to build for next week's taping?" And I say, "Well, nothing's written. We don't have our guest stars yet." He says, "I got to start building the sets now. You're not going to have them."
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say, "Okay, build a." Build a gymnasium and build a restaurant. And we'd write sketches. Once we got the guest stars, we'd write sketches to fit them. So I went into Marty Krofft's office one time, and he says, "I got us a guest star for next week. You got to go up to his house and talk to him." I go, "Okay, who am I going to go see? He says, you got a 1 o'clock appointment with Hugh Hefner.
And you got to go to his house. You poor thing.
Hey, poor guy. Yeah.
Oh, that was a hard day for you.
There. Yeah. And I was fascinated by the guy. I mean, it was just.
Was he charismatic and captivating?
Yeah, he's a nice man. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you one moment with Hefner. We bonded when I mentioned Harvey Kurtzman, that I knew Harvey Kurtzman.
I don't know who Harvey Kurtzman is.
Harvey Kurtzman did Little Annie Fanny.
Yeah.
He what?
Harvey Kurtzman drew Little Annie Fanny. And Harvey Kurtzman was the first editor of Mad Magazine before that.
Oh, okay.
So, but we were sitting in Hefner's. Hefner comes in his pajamas, we're sitting there, and while we're talking to him, somebody interrupts him, and they bring him the sales figures from the previous month's issue of Playboy. The final sales figures are in for a certain recent issue. And he looks at them and he goes, "That's amazing. I thought it was a bad issue, and it sold one of the highest selling ones of the year." And he turns to me and he says to me, "This is Hugh Hefner. I swear to you, he sent me this word. He said these words to me. He said to me." You know, after all these years I've been doing this, I still don't know what makes one issue sell and another one doesn't. Huh. And I think to myself, I've been in the comic book business for 25 years. I've never met a single executive in the business who would say that. Hugh Hefner can say that.
Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
You know, everybody I've ever met in the comic book business said, "Oh, I know what'll sell. I got my finger on the pulse beat of the readership. I know exactly how many copies something will sell. I can predict it perfectly." And here's Hugh Hefner. Nobody's ever been more successful publishing in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there admitting to me he doesn't know what will sell.
Wow.
And I thought that was...
That's the industry, right?
Yeah, I guess I guess you can say those kind of things when you own the company.
Sure.
But, but nevertheless, you'd think he would say, "Oh, yes, I know everything. I'm an expert." That candor.
Yeah, but very, why? You know, when he's sitting up on the... You know, we talked about being up on top of the mountain. When you're sitting up there, why do you have to be brilliant? Why can't you learn? It's more fun that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's really magical. I've never heard that story before. That's really neat.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing that was great about working with the Crofts was that there was always something, there was always a dance number, there was always a musical number, there was always something going on. It was just a very colorful existence. You know, auditioning dancers or writing songs. And I got to write songs on those shows. I got to write special musical material. I got to write lyrics.
Did you get to write lines for the flute in H.R. Puff and Stuff?
No. Puff and Stuff was on the Bay City Rollers show.
Oh, okay.
And I wrote for Puff and Stuff, but not on the H.R. Puff and Stuff show. But Sid and Marty were so... They were like the last of the entrepreneurs. They're the last of the big showmen. The guys who could produce huge things with feathers and huge things. And we did a... shows that went $150,000 over budget because Marty was so obsessed with production value and make sure we have big sets and great costumes and things like that. They spent money like crazy on those things. And I love spending money when it's on the screen.
Yeah.
I think that's wonderful. I don't mind that too much. And they'd make it back on something else eventually. I like guys who gamble like that. They say, "Let's spend a lot of money on this. We'll hope we'll make it back on something else."
Mm-hmm.
And they did that a number of times.
Because they believed in the magic of it.
Yeah, and they had the great pride in Croft production. Yeah. They didn't want people to say, "Oh, Sid and Marty did a cheap show."
Do you ever think you'll work with them again on something?
Yeah, I think so. I've talked to them about a couple of things.
Hmm. I'd love to see them come back and be that, you know, entertainment force again.
Yeah. They're they're just originals, and there are very few name producers. You know, most of the people listening to this podcast right now can name. Oh, they know who Chuck Lorre is. They know who a couple of the top comedy producers are. Dramatic producers.
Phil Rosenthal.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. But Lorne Michaels. How many people can you name who did variety shows?
Yeah.
And variety shows are a different type of thing because variety shows are production and spectacle and music and dance and things like that and puppets sometimes.
Mm-hmm. They don't see a lot of that anymore. I mean, they don't see professional big shows anymore. It's now American Idol and it's X Factor and it's stuff like that. And that's one of the things I miss, you know, with all this entertainment back on TV. I miss professionals. I miss professionals who do interesting things, not just... You know, it can be somebody. It can be a rock band. It can be someone who sings an aria or spins a plate, or something like the old Ed Sullivan show. And I don't know. I've heard it argued that Americans only want to see a mirror of themselves. Like, they have more invested in seeing somebody from nowhere getting up and singing with a professional with a shot at stardom. But I think there's room for both. You know, I want to see big-time show business back on TV.
We also are at an age where consuming, you know, like the consumption of these acts is rapid and instant.
Well,
and
on the internet,
you know, I mean, because of the internet and the wide distribution and multimedia platforms, you know, instead of just having, like, we, for example, and I don't mean to, you know, to get off track here, but we went and saw Max Maven interview James Randi a while back. The three of us went together. Yes. And, well, actually just the two of us. I don't think you came with us.
Well, I went to the first evening that he had, but not the more recent one.
Yeah. But they were talking about how if you were on Carson, you couldn't walk down the street for weeks without people recognizing you because Carson was it. He was the one-stop shop for late night, and especially for something like Variety Acts, or that was a huge, you know, like they talk about you getting your big break.
Yeah.
That was a huge break to be on Carson. Whereas now, if you're on Carson Daly, Jimmy Fallon, Conan O'Brien, I mean, there's such a smorgasbord of things to consume. Also, you know, going back to Harry Houdini's days, Harry Houdini could do the same act for years and years and years. He could hone and refine that act and take it town to town, and these people had never seen it before. Now, some poor guy like Charlie Fry has been working his whole life on putting this amazing act together, and fortunately for Charlie Fry, he's versatile and a very clever dude. But to put your whole self and all this time in, people see it once on YouTube and say, oh yeah, we saw that guy. And you work your whole life on honing and refining this act. They've seen you once and you're done.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes viral. And now 36 million of people have seen it, which is great. But then they say, what else you got? And it's like, well, I kind of did that for 20 years. And they're like, yeah, but what else you got? And it's like, and so.
Yeah, there's no more acts like that. But then you also don't have entertainers. People specialize now. There's no Danny Kaye of the modern era.
Mm-hmm.
There's no Carol Burnett of the modern era.
Agreed.
No, you don't have people who are singers and comedians and dancers at the same time, all those things.
Well, and not only that, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I just want to get this out so you can keep talking.
Yes.
Paul and I were just talking the other day about how someone like Phil Silvers had such a distinctive voice. And a lot of that, I think you and I have talked at one time, came from vaudeville because they had to. You know, like, first of all, developing that voice that would carry, but also they could be identified by that thing that they did that made them stand out. Now they're all kind of the same. And it's like, here's, oh, well, she's got brown hair. Well, Kim Kardashian looks just like this one that had the same plastic surgeon, that had the same whatever. And there's so much there's such an amalgamation and a generality. Everything's homogenized, whereas back then that Muggsy's really having a dream there. But, you know, it feels like everything's very homogenized, whereas the individuality was what really skyrocketed these people forward. Now I'm done talking, and I'll turn it back over.
Oh, no, What you're saying is absolutely right. I mean, but it's just, I got into kind of an end of an era. I got in time to work with the Bob Hopes and the Jerry Lewis's a little bit.
That's amazing.
And I don't think it's something comparable today. I mean, there's some wonderful people today, some great comedy stars out there, but I don't think they have the timelessness of those guys because they're not going to transcend a lot of different media, and they're not going to transcend. You know, the business uses up people too fast now.
It does.
And nobody. I don't think people are going to be stars as long. Today's stars are going to be stars as long as Milton Berle was a star. Or such.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, Jack Benny. We use people up too fast.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you mentioned Milton Berle. I was watching an old Looney Tune from, like, I don't know, 1938, 1940, and he was in it, caricatured as Milton Squirrel. And then you flash forward 43 years to Broadway Danny Rose, and he's got his big supporting part in it, and he's still, you know, bigger than ever in that movie. And he lived for at least, I guess, when did he pass away? It was like 20 years after that.
He was about 94.
Yeah.
He was around a while.
So he was such an icon that, you know, you can be lampooned in cartoons in the 30s, then, you know, co-star with Woody Allen in the 80s, and then, you know, check out in the late 90s, and then, you know, still
be well known.
Still be well known, yeah.
What he was, yeah.
And I have a crass, well, it's not really crass, but kind of. Milt Larson told me a story about Milton Berle. When he was working with him, he had written a gag, and Milton Berle appreciated it a great deal. And wanted to meet the guy who wrote this gag because he clearly understood. I guess it was an old vaudeville sketch he had revived for a show that he was working on. And he went in and shook Milton Berle's hand and said, "My name is Milt, too." And Milton Berle looked at him and said, "No, Milt is the semen of a male fish. Your name is Milton." And I guess that is what the word milt means. It's like the reproductive gland in a fish. And Milton Berle said, "Don't ever, ever call me Milt."
Oh.
And Milt Larson said, "Well, my name is Milt." Oh. And he was like, "Ooh." You know, but he got really vehement. Like, "No. That is a vile, vulgar thing to call yourself."
Berle was a very odd man. I met him a few times, and he was had a lot of very strident opinions, and here's how show business has to work, and you know, and I invented all this, and I invented all that. And, you know, he's one of those guys, I never found him that funny, but I respected the work. And he was
sure.
in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I can't,
yeah.
I can't dislike anybody who's in that
yeah.
movie. It's not possible.
Questions from the fans.
Cole There's Rathaker that. Says,
"Oh, hi, Cole. Dip. He's one of my Twitter buddies."
That's right. He says, "Could you ask him, meaning Mark, if he has any books in the same vein as Kirby, King of Comics, in the works, or any book, any kind of book, really?"
I have no books in the works. I'm talking about some, but they're not in the works. They're just speculative stuff that we. I've got a couple of publishers who want me to do books on comic history. I do have a lengthy biography of Jack that is still a few years from being published for reasons that people will understand when it comes out.
Nice.
I see. Balls Monkey asks, "If Mark had to choose between any of the GOP candidates or Darkseid to run the country for the next 4 years, who would he pick?"
That's kind of like six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yeah.
He would pick Rashi.
Darkseid cannot be president of the United States because he was not born in this country.
That's true.
But other than that, he'd be better than Newt.
Darkseid looks better in a skirt than Newt, I think.
We just or can't have Galactus because he'll just eat
or whatever
the
it is he will.
Yes.
What? Isn't it Galactus the planet eater?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it looks like Newt could give him a run for his money.
Well, he's given us the moon. That's where that came from. It's just really friggin' obscure.
I think those are the two presidents.
No, there were more, weren't there?
No, that was it. No. Zachules writes, "I read Mark's essay about the D&D cartoon and the horrid reason for Eric's character. Can you talk more about that? Fascinating."
There's not that much to it. There was a time when network television, Saturday morning children's television, was very much subjected to pressure groups, parents groups, educational groups, demanding that certain morals be taught.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of the trade-off. The networks essentially said, "Look, leave our advertising alone and we'll let you do whatever you want to the content of the shows."
Wow.
Oh, man.
And so the networks would be told by various people, "You've got to promote this method or message or that message." One of the messages we were told to insert for a while into cartoons was a message that I did not believe in. And it was, "The group is always right." You don't want to be a complainer. You should go along with, be part of society. If all your friends want to go for Chinese food and you want to go for Mexican food, go along and go for Chinese food. There was even a TV show on CBS called The Get Along Gang.
I remember
which
that.
The premise of which was, let's get along with the gang.
Uh-huh.
I didn't believe in that message. There's a cartoon I wrote, a Garfield, called Big Bad Buddy Bird, which I spent savaging that message.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to it, you know, kids, have a brain of your own.
Yeah.
Don't do things just because your friends do them. I didn't know why, in an era of Crips and Bloods, we were teaching kids to go along with the gang.
Yeah.
Didn't your friend tell you that, you know, just because your friends jumped off a bridge doesn't mean you
yeah.
should too?
I mean, there is a value to sometimes cooperating. And to not being contrary for the sake of being contrary,
yeah.
That's fine. But that's not what we were teaching, and in particular, we were teaching a moral that I don't think any of us believed in.
Not if you're a member of a democratic society that prizes individuality.
So when I developed the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon show, the character of Eric, who was called Percy before I got to him, and I thought we needed to give him more of a contemporary name. Eric was a complainer, and in every episode, they all wanted to go to the West. He'd want to go to the East,
mm-hmm.
and he was always wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't agree with that message, but we had to put it in, and you know, it's one of those compromises you make. and I didn't like it. And I think it was wrong. There were a lot of messages in those cartoons that I thought were hokey ones.
Well, I think it's really interesting that, okay, you mentioned the Get Along Gang. There was also Shirt Tales, the Smurf, certainly. And they all as you said, and this was something I had a tremendous amount of problems with, like in the early 80s. And I would get into big fights with network people over it. And they'd say, no, you know, we're trying to do cooperation. We are trying to say the group think is good. And it's like bullshit. You want to have, you know, you don't want any character rising to the fore and taking charge. You want to show that the individual is weak and there can be no strength, you know, outside of the group. More importantly, you know, you also want to show, oh, everybody is all equal, no matter what their background or ethnicity is. And it's all homogenous. And I'd say, well, you know, and I got in this fight with somebody at ABC, and I said, what do you get the best ratings on? And they say, Bugs Bunny. And I said, well, Bugs Bunny is a solo character. He's a character who's persecuted, thinks for himself, and does something. So yes, but that is totally different.
They
totally
hated
different.
Bugs Bunny.
They liked the ratings.
Well, but they didn't like Bugs Bunny. The Status of Practice people didn't like Bugs Bunny.
Why?
Yeah.
Because the show, the cartoons didn't teach anything. They didn't teach, they didn't promote, quote, pro-social values. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago on this show that I did this special for ABC on the history of children's television.
Yes.
And at one point they told us, you can't put Johnny Quest in there. We hate it.
Whoa. What?
And I said, Johnny Quest is going in. They said, and this is the Standards and Practices people. And they said, that's the show that ruined everything. And I went,
what does that mean?
Good. I mean, that's the show that made it. That was the first real adventure cartoon made for television.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that was the precursor of all these superheroes and monster shows and realistic things. And this one lady at ABC, probably the same one you dealt with, didn't like that. And she wanted us to drop Johnny Quest out and not acknowledge its existence. And
frickin' hideous dragons, every last one of them.
But you see, the thing was that I found was that the counter argument was, we're lying to children. To most of these Standards and Practices notes, we're lying to children. We're telling them that people rob banks without guns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're telling them, there was an episode, there's a cartoon show called Pole Position. A friend of mine wrote an episode.
Based on the video game?
Based on the video game.
Oh my goodness.
And a friend of mine wrote an episode, and there was a scene where, in order to save the day, the hero had to cut a rope.
Okay.
And if you cut the rope in time, you don't need to know why, but if we cut that rope, the villain will be foiled. Quick, cut the rope.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend wrote the script with the character pulls out a pocket knife and cuts the rope. And they said, no, kids can't use knives.
What?
So they had to cut the rope with a sharp knife, a sharp rock.
Oh,
now, the rope was lowering a car, by the way.
Right? Of
course. So I said, no, I got involved in this argument, even though it wasn't my script. We're lying to the kids. We're telling them that sharp rocks, you can grab a sharp rock and cut a rope that's strong enough to hold
a car.
Even the pocket knife was stretching, pushing it a bit.
Yeah.
But that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you could make a cut into the rope, and then the pressure would cause the rope to part. And then when you got to these scenes where someone's robbing a bank and they don't have guns, they just run in and grab the money and run out. That's not realistic.
No.
And we kept having these things happen. I wrote a Richie Rich cartoon that we went to the mat on. And the premise of it was one of my favorite Richie Riches we did. We had this old guard who was on the Rich estate. Richie Rich is, you know, this mansion with $87 gazillion. And we had this old guard who's being retired, Pops, I think we called him. He's being retired because he's hit a certain age, and they're bringing in the new robotic guards to take over for guys like Pops. They're not going to have human guards anymore. They're going to have the robotic ones. And I had a scene where the guys who bring in the robotic one basically say, hey, too bad, Pops, but you're old and washed up and useless.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the course of the episode later, the villain managed to nuke the robotic guards, and Pops comes back in and saves the day. And I thought the story told a couple of very valid messages. One is, just because you have a calculator doesn't mean you shouldn't know how to learn how to add. Native skills trump technology. Another one is, old people do not become useless just because they hit a certain age. Grandma is not going to break because she's 65 or she's not, you know, you don't have to force them to retire. They're not useless. And there's a couple of other ones in there, a couple of little morals, but this, those are the two big ones. And you know, don't underestimate somebody just because you're new and they're not. So anyway, they said you can't have them making fun of the old guy. You can't have the robot technician saying, "Hey, you're washed up."
Why?
Because that's being cruel. That's teaching kids imitatable behavior. Then kids are going to be rude to their grandparents.
No.
And I went, no, this episode teaches them that's wrong. And we fought about that, and they just, it was, I finally got to do a slightly watered down version of what I wanted. But they just had these little bullet points here and there that struck me as very arbitrary in some cases, but also very shallow. Like the premise was, well, what if, they actually said to me in that one case, what if the kid only watches the first half of the cartoon?
Okay.
So I said, well, in any cartoon in the world that's got a villain in it, the villain has to have some moment of triumph early on, or he's not a formidable villain. So therefore, what if the kid only watched the first half of that cartoon? He doesn't see the villain get captured. He's going to think that bank robbing is good.
Exactly.
So it was a case of kind of like, we don't like it. So we'll make up a reason. That's gone away. We don't have that much anymore. There are only a few taboos on Saturday morning, and they're actually fairly sensible ones. Things that you know, kids could have imitated. There are a couple of things you can't do on children's television because kids did them, maimed themselves, and somebody sued the network.
So do you know of any specific examples?
Well, the big one, the number one thing when I was doing shows for CBS, we could not do was electrocute anybody. Because apparently there was a kid who, you know, the joke was somebody stuck their finger in a fire in an electrical socket in some cartoon, and some kid did it and hurt himself or was, you know. So,
well, I mean, you know, Paul taught his little brother a magic trick that he saw in Popeye. Have we ever talked? I don't think we've ever talked about that on here.
Oh, well,
it's very quick.
It was just you know, I saw Popeye do this trick where he put a towel over Bluto's head and then hit him in the eye.
Oh,
and I thought that was really funny. I did that to my little brother because I just thought, man, that's really funny. He takes the thing away, he's got a black eye. Hey, Bruce, come here. And but still, you know, nobody wrote in about that. I think it's just like, don't hit your brother, that sort of thing. No, but the network at that time, a lot of their rules were really arbitrary. And it was very frustrating. This was like around 83, 84, or even earlier, like the late 70s. And there were a lot of people getting into animation at that time who had grown up on Tex Avery and Bugs Bunny and the Disney cartoons. And now, okay, I know I'm in Saturday morning and I know the budgets aren't great, but I really want to make some cartoons. And then just to be this legion of dragons who'd come in so self-important, so pumped up on these half-truths and the the educational reports by the experts and waving them in our faces and saying, you're wrong. Everything you loved as a child, every cartoon you loved and that you want to do and strike out for yourself, you're all wrong. And it was maddening dealing with those. And, you know, it would just drive you crazy if you let it. You know, we all suffered with those. And then things got a little bit better.
So,
yeah, when we started doing Garfield and Friends, we wanted the network to leave us alone. The network wasn't even reading the scripts. And I went to the standards and practices guy, and he seemed to be a very decent guy. And I said, look, just tell me what the rules are here. I won't make your life miserable. You don't make my life miserable. And he gave me a list of about 12 things. And he said, if you guys can just avoid doing these 12 things, you can do anything you want. And we didn't do those 12 things. And he stopped reading the scripts, and he would approve them without seeing them. And in the 7 years we did Garfield, we never had a network note that we had to change.
Wow.
Not once. Because I avoided those 12 things. And there were
that
things like, you know, electrocuting somebody, driving without seatbelts. They're very reasonable.
Common sense.
Choking someone around the neck.
Oh, probably not a good idea.
I mean, but I can write a cartoon without choking someone around the neck.
But mm-hmm. being on the outside, it doesn't seem like a lot of these standards and practice type people give those that information. You go, what can I do? And they go, well, just don't do it. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing that people should know about when we talk about Saturday morning censorship and stuff like that is that one of the reasons that the cartoons were laundered the way they were, that things were cut out, was that the Bill Hannas of the world wanted to give in on everything instantly and not fight it. I would win battles on Richie Rich. I would win battles with standards and practices. I would fight them over things, and they'd agree to withdraw their notes, and I'd find out Bill Hanna already made the cut on the storyboard because A, they didn't want to slow production for a second to wait for the time for me to argue it. They just would make the changes and go on. Because it might mean a show would ship to the Philippines for animation a day later. Mm-hmm. And secondly, they kind of wanted to launder this stuff because they were looking at the future value of the syndication package. And they thought, well, what if the standards get more tense in the future? We don't want to not be able to, because there was a period when they couldn't sell Johnny Quest in the syndication because it was too violent. Mm-hmm. And they kind of wished that they had made it less violent because they wanted the money from. So if the standards practice people said this is too violent, a lot of times, you know, Bill Hanna or whoever at other studios who was comparable would make the changes instantly. And you know, Paul, from dealing in live action shows,
sure,
you have to fight over these things. When I did like Welcome Back Cotter or any of those other shows, or those variety shows at the Crofts, the standards and practice people would come in with 35 notes, and we'd talk them out of 28 of them. Mm-hmm. In Hanna-Barbera, if they give us 35 notes, Bill Hanna would make 35 changes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And wouldn't let us make those. So, you know, and then Joe Barbera would complain, oh, the networks ruin our shows. And I'd say, no, Joe, I mean, sometimes you guys ruin them that way.
Yeah, I mean, I know on Lost, I didn't have to fight those battles personally, but I remember every time Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse would head over for a meeting, it would be like, well, you take the sword, I'll take the trident, and, you know, it's like they're going into to fight a battle.
When I was doing That's Incredible,
yeah,
I was also story editing Richie Rich at the same time.
Wow.
And we had the same standards and practices lady for both shows. They're both on ABC. And I would trade off, I'll cut this on That's Incredible if you let me keep this on Richie Rich.
Mm.
And I'd make a deal with her.
Mm.
And
she probably appreciated that.
She was willing to do it because she was desperate to get a certain, you know, there'll be a certain change. She was adamant she had to get, and if she had to give up something else, she would. Because standards of practice is a very political job.
Oh. You know,
and it's a matter
of... Well, it's a very subjective job, too.
Subjective job. It's basically, what you have to do is, your job is to make sure the network doesn't get complaints.
Okay. Ooh.
We had a joke on Welcome Back, Cotter, that... was cut because people would misunderstand it. We had this joke, and the joke was this student teacher had a book, and somebody said, "Is that a Bible?" And she says, "Oh no, I'm not a criminal. I'd never bring a Bible into a classroom," or something like that. The joke was kind of pro Bible. It's like, isn't it awful that, I mean, it's not a viewpoint I agree with, but the joke was written, and
because it is illegal, isn't it?
Yeah. And so
I was like, wait a minute, okay.
And ABC said, you got to cut that. We're going to get angry letters from people who are pro-Bible. And we said, but the joke is pro-Bible. He said, and they basically said, those people will complain the minute they hear
Bible and criminal
in the same sentence. Mm-hmm. They will scream about that. We don't want the headache. Take it out.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
We had a joke one time. Again, in Cotter, when there was a history lesson going on, and John Travolta's character, Vinny, said, somebody was talking about Hitler, and he says, I don't understand Hitler. Why would anyone want Poland? You know, and they said, you got to take that out. It's a Polish joke. And we say, well, they say, can you change it to Romania? No, Hitler didn't invade Romania, you know?
Right.
You know, it was just things like that. You get these silly notes. But the point is, you can fight them.
Yeah.
And I have a story that's probably too long to tell here about how we would ignore STEM standards and practices notes completely, and they'd never notice.
Oh, my gosh.
So.
Mm. The big bugaboo now.
Next time I come back, remind me to tell you the standards.
I'll put it on your list because you still have 6 more items here.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a list of 7. Wait. I started with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then it went up to 14. And now it's down to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So I'll have a list of 6 to start with next time, which means it'll go up to 40.
That's yeah. Right.
And then we'll cover none of it. So you'll have to come back again.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Paul, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say, it's kind of ironic now, the big bugaboo that I hear from broadcast standards is bullying. Like, they're so anti-bullying. Like, bullying is the big, like, in the last year, this is like, they've put on whole anti-bullying committees.
Yeah.
And, you know, you watch certain networks and they just have, you know, they don't even run commercials. They just run the same, you know, public service announcement. No bullying. Get a teacher. Get an adult. Yeah. And
Paul, tell them if they don't stop that, we're going to beat them up and take their lunch money.
I know,
yes.
I know.
Exactly.
But I there was
that's funny.
But it's ironic because, again, talking to the same networks, they all say, you know, we're doing a lot of shows that are all about kids because only kids can see kids in cartoons, and every cartoon, even if it stars a kid, has to have the kid in school dealing with normal school life. So they buy all these shows. And of course, there are bullies in school. And now the bully committees are saying, don't show any bullying in school. What are you doing? It's so wrong. They've got this weird catch-22. I remember, this is really weird. This is something that would probably, you know, cause these people to drop dead on the spot in shock. But remember the original campaign for Applejack cereal?
Yes, Bowl a Day Keeps the Bullies Away, sung by Paul Frees.
Yeah.
It
and,
was.
And that's it would
awesome.
It would have these kids, you know, like, hey, you know, a little kid being bullied, like, hey, look at the squirt over there. Oh, we'll get him. And then he eats a bowl of Apple Jacks. It's like Popeye. He goes back and he frightens the bullies away. You can't.
And he became a bully in return.
Yeah. You can't even mention bullying in a fun, whimsical way like that anymore.
And see, even like me, just being of a different generation, I'm like, oh, you could never do that. Like, that shocked me. It's so funny how puritanistic and self-righteous we become.
Everything from that era. I mean, I can't tell you all the products that were, you know, prefaced by the words heap big, you know, like, you know,
oh,
heap
yeah.
big orangeade, you know, or you know, like.
Well, even your anti-littering campaign had the Indian with one rolling tear.
Well, that was more positive, but I remember like they would use like the Western imagery to sell everything, sneakers, TV dinners, you know, like.
It was very American.
But you know, cowboys and Indians were big for kids in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had, you know, Big Chief Orange of the Funny Face drink or whatever it was called.
Engine Orange.
That's even worse. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Choo Choo Cherry, Chinese Cherry.
Chinese Cherry.
Chinese Cherry became Choo Choo Cherry, that's right.
They actually changed those to make them, you know, really quick to make them less racist.
What were they, candy?
It was like a Kool-Aid type drink.
Yeah, funny face.
Oh, okay.
Funny face.
Powdered drink mix.
Jolly Olly Orange.
And they were also voiced by Paul Frees.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Awesome.
That's right.
All that stuff.
Well, we're at 72 minutes and I'm not done talking to you.
But we have to go. It is late.
I know. So you'll come back?
If you'll give me a dollar.
I will give you a dollar.
And we'll get more pizza.
Yeah, we'll get more pizza next time.
Good pizza.
Was it good?
Yes, good pizza.
Glad you liked it. We'll get it for you again. Mark, thank you so much for sharing an entire month of your life chained to our
couch. That's right. I've been here the entire. Fortunately, it was February. It's a short month.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So that's
good.
Not leap year.
You know, I was almost born on leap year day.
Really?
Yeah, I was due on February 29th. I'd be 15 if that were the case.
Still.
By the time this airs, it'll almost be your birthday.
Thank you. That's Woo! Exciting. Yes.
Yeah. We'll have to do something fun to celebrate.
Countdown to Avenir's birthday month.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That I like.
Never mind that. It's going to be creamy tomato soup month at Soup Plantation.
What, in March or February?
Is February creamy
March.
Tomato?
No, March okay. is.
They do that for your birthday.
That's right. Just for my birthday.
That's the only reason.
Have my favorite soup.
All over the country. All soup plantations. Yeah. Are they countrywide or are they just California?
They're called sweet tomatoes in other countries, in other states.
Okay.
Really?
All
yes.
right. And
they're not in every state at all, but some of them are sweet tomatoes and some of them are soup plantations.
Mm-hmm. Well, that soup is delicious and I'm glad for your birthday for many, many reasons.
Thank
but
you,
most
yes.
of all for you.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you for sharing so much time with us.
Thank you for having me out.
This is delightful.
Yeah. You're just great.
Oh, shucks. Oh, pshaw.
Scott, like pshaw. The boost in ratings.
Emily, it's been 4 weeks since we've heard anything from you. Will you just pick up the microphone and say something?
I think my mic's finally on.
I only turned it off because you had it sitting on the couch.
Just say underpants.
Underpants.
Underpants. There underpants. We go. That's what we get from
that's,
Emily.
That's a dignified thing to go out on is yeah. underpants.
It is. Thank you. And thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And we love everybody. And happy birthday to you, Mark. And happy February. Evan, your month. And woo. We'll have him back again. Because I have 6 more things on my freaking list. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes Store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.